Greetings and felicitations, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this June 2011 Science News Update. I'm your host for this evening of pure and adulterated wonder and hedonist exhortations, Jim Campanella. Let's get this show on the road. I have a ton of stories to tell you tonight. First, if you haven't heard it yet in your local newspapers, there was a recent birth announcement for two new chemical elements, number 114 and number 116. If you do not remember, the number of the element refers to the number of protons in their nuclei, which give them their little box on the periodic chart. A couple of pieces of background on this. First, the new bouncing baby elements do not have names yet. The International Committee will vote on those in the next couple of months. Of course, the general public could not care any less. I have thought on this lack of interest, and I say, given the current dementia that the general public has with reality TV shows, perhaps the physicists may be able to get their attention by calling the new elements Ryan Seacrestium, or the Situanium, or perhaps Snookium. Sorry. The new elements were made by slamming two lighter elements together in the hopes that they'd stick. And they did, but the resulting elements only lasted less than a second. Mind you, that less than a second is time enough in existence, and that the Carnegie Mellon researchers could reproduce it well enough so that they were given the go-ahead to announce their findings to the world. Elements at the high end of the periodic chart have never been able to be very stable. Note that elements 113 and 115 are still not part of the chart, even though 114 and 116 have now been accepted. No one has been able to stably reproduce 113 or 115, and so they are still in periodic table purgatory, as one reporter stated. The total number of officially recognized elements is now at 114. Next story. Those of you who are Stephen R. Donaldson fans may have wondered for years where his anti-hero Thomas Covenant got his leprosy from. I read Donaldson's Lord Fowl's Bane decades ago, and I believe it was always kind of left a mystery. Well, now I can tell you where Thomas Covenant, the unbeliever, got his disease. It was most likely an armadillo. All right, I'm kidding. Probably not. But it appears that armadillos are a lot less cuddly than one may think. Dr. Richard Truman and his collaborators at Louisiana State University reported in the April 28th New England Journal of Medicine that many infected people in the Deep South contract leprosy while close to home, not in some exotic location where the disease is more common. The only possible infectious agents would be an armadillo or another person. Some of the infected people had even handled armadillos, the only animal known to harbor leprosy. People infected with leprosy in the U.S. often have the same previously unknown strain of the microbe Mycobacterium leprae that is also carried by armadillos. Though it's been known for decades that armadillos can harbor leprosy, also called Hansen's disease, the discovery of the overlapping strains strengthens the long-held assumptions that armadillos can infect people directly. Truman and his colleagues compared bacterial samples from 50 patients in Louisiana and 33 infected wild armadillos from 5 southern states. They found a highly specific strain of the bacterium showing up in 28 of the 33 animals and in 22 of 29 patients who had never lived outside the U.S. or in Mexico. Interviews with 15 of the leprosy patients further revealed that 8 had had direct contact with armadillos. The research states that roughly 6 to 10% of armadillos tested in Alabama and Mississippi have leprosy. Other studies place the rate as high as 20% in the wild. That's 20 out of 100. That's a lot of armadillos. There are many kinds of armadillos in Latin America, including the nine-banded armadillo, the only one found in the United States, but it's not known if other types contract leprosy. Since the 1840s, when it was first recorded that armadillos lived in southern Texas, mainly near the lower Rio Grande, nine-banded armadillos have expanded their range to much of the Deep South and northward to the tip of southern Illinois. It remains unclear how an armadillo can actually transmit leprosy. Truman speculates close contact is required, and he says, quote, actual causality is difficult to confirm, unquote. It's not clear whether armadillos, which get sick from leprosy, are infectious during the long incubation period actually preceding the symptoms. but it's well known that leprosy spreads among people. Truman also stated, quote, "The limited exposure people have to armadillos means that some person-to-person transmission must be happening in southern states where the cases show up." Leprosy remains very rare in the U.S., with about 150 new cases every year, so do not freak out and think you're going to join Thomas Covenant in his land or anything like that. Also, since the 1970s, when Donaldson first started writing the Thomas Covenant books, gosh, I feel old, the disease is curable now. Mind you, it's not one shot and be done with it, but it is curable. It can require more than a year of antibiotics to do those nasty little bacteria in, but they do give up the ghost eventually. Don't tell your dog about the next story, or you may plunge him into an abyss of depression, or perhaps your cat may be even more upset. According to an upcoming report in the journal Biology Letters by Dr. A.W. Crompton of Harvard University, dogs drink just like cats do, even though it doesn't quite look the same to the naked eye, or for that matter, sound the same. Dogs plunge their tongues into liquid, and like cats, swiftly pull up a little column of it through adhesion. Before gravity overcomes the column's inertia, and the liquid splashes down into the bowl again, the dogs snatch a sip of liquid. High-speed video using X-rays show that dogs get liquids into their mouths by relying on the way that the liquid adheres to the tongue and the inertia of the liquid columns. It was speculated for a long time that the splashy laps of dogs appear to rely on a different technique than cats. If you look at this on just plain video, the canine tongue curls down into the water and catches a little pool in its curve. Dogs, researchers suspected, were nothing more than scoopers of water. But it doesn't appear to be so, says Dr. Crompton. His observations now show that any water scooped by the dog's tongue falls out as the tongue moves back into the mouth. As in cats, it's the top of the liquid column that's the real drink. Crompton says, quote, "Cats are just a little neater than dogs are." Crompton's X-ray analysis of the drinking also adds a new chapter to the story of lapping by detailing how liquid gets from the front of the tongue to the swallowing point. The tongue traps the water against the ridged roof of the mouth. As the tongue moves out again and again for subsequent laps, the captured bit of liquid travels back. A particular bit of captured liquid may need maybe 3 tongue extensions to actually get swallowed. Crompton says that cats probably do that too. The authors do state that the oral cavities are similar for cats and dogs, so the creature's similar lapping habits should not be all that much of a shock. Next is a bit of a technology update from MIT's Technology Journal. For anybody who's ever had trouble sleeping or worried that they may have sleep apnea, well, a new bit of frippery from Nix Devices may help you. The Nix company is now offering, that's NYX, they are now offering pajamas that actually have built-in sleep monitors. The company developed a nightshirt embedded with fabric electronics to monitor the wearer's breathing patterns. A small chip worn in the pocket of the shirt processes the data to determine the phase of sleep, such as REM sleep when we dream, light sleep, or deep sleep. Dr. Matt Bianchi, a sleep neurologist at Massachusetts General and co-inventor of the shirt, says, quote, "It has no adhesive and doesn't need any special setup to wear." When people with sleep disorders spend the night in a sleep lab, they're hooked up to a complex array of sensors that monitor brain activity, muscle activity, eye movement, heart, and breathing rates. The Nix company's new sleep shirt dramatically simplifies this by focusing only on respiration. Says Bianchi, quote, "It turns out you can tell if someone is awake or asleep and which stage of sleep they're in purely based on their breathing patterns. That's a much easier signal to analyze than electrical activity from the brain. During REM sleep, the respiratory pattern is irregular with differences in the size of breaths and spacing between them. Breathing during sleep follows a much more ordered pattern. Deep, non-REM sleep shows smaller and more regular breaths. The idea behind the sleep shirt is to allow repeated measurements over time at home. Users can log their habits such as coffee or alcohol intake, exercise or stress, and look for patterns on how those variables affect their quality of sleep. Analyzing sleep stages based on respiration alone is still considered experimental, But Bianchi is now testing the device on patients who come to his sleep clinic, who are also assessed using standard and more complex technology, so that he can make comparisons between the two. Nix will soon begin home tests of the shirts to further validate its use outside the lab. The company hopes to have a commercial product available by next summer, 2012, and the shirt should cost less than $100. While Nix sees their new product as one for consumers, Bianchi simply wants to use it for his patients. Bianchi's previous research has shown that people with insomnia often underestimate how much they actually sleep, so he wants to determine whether giving them an objective way to measure sleep will help them reassess their condition and improve quality of sleep. He says, quote, "It will be a game changer for my clinical practice. There are zero objective tools available to physicians to assess insomnia right now," unquote. The next story involves the history of the mail order bride. Well, sort of, kind of, almost. You would have thought that in early human history, tribes would have been composed of groups of men and women who pretty much grew up near each other and stayed together, like you would expect in a village or a town. But, according to a story in the June 2nd issue of the journal Nature by anthropologist Dr. Sandy Copeland of the Max Planck Institute and her colleagues, that ain't necessarily so. Our ideas of villages and idealized tribes of families in the ancient past are not quite so correct. In fact, males and females in early history apparently acted in very different ways. Most males spent their entire lives in a home region that covered no more than about 28 square kilometers, or about half the area of Manhattan, according to Copeland. These ancient fellows may have occasionally gone further afield, exploiting resources along wooded areas atop bands of bedrock in Africa that extend about 30 kilometers in opposite directions. All this information came from South African cave sites where their fossils were discovered. The big difference is that adult females of the time often moved from the places where they were born to distant locations, presumably to find mates among unrelated males, something that was very important for genetics to be continued in a healthy way. When it comes down to it, genetic diversity is just as important to hominids as it is for eelgrass. I refer you to last month's Science News update on eelgrass genetic health. Copeland says that it's not clear how far females actually traveled to reach new groups, only that they did not grow up where they died. Copeland measured a chemical marker of childhood diet in teeth from 19 hominids found in two caves about 1 kilometer apart. The specimens represented two different human ancestors. 11 Paranthropus robustus individuals from about 1.8 million years ago, and 8 Australopithecus africanus from 2.2 million years ago. Copeland's group measured levels of two forms of strontium in the hominid's tooth enamel and in plants and animals now living within 50 kilometers of the fossil sites. Strontium naturally occurs in rocks and soils. Specific strontium signatures characterize different landscapes. The scientists estimate that the strontium signatures in A. africanus and P. robustus teeth were defined by their diet and should have developed by age 9 or so. Collective strontium data for both the species indicated that 8 of 9 large-toothed individuals, presumably males because of the big teeth, grew up in the area where they died. However, at least 5 of 10 small-toothed individuals, again thought to be females because of small teeth, grew up elsewhere from where they actually lived most of their lives and died. This is not without any modern precedent. Chimps and gorilla females leave their birth groups upon reaching reproductive age to find new tribes. It's been a controversy for a while about whether early humans probably did the same thing. And Copeland's group was the first to find evidence that those early humans probably did do the same thing. Copeland says that Paranthropus and Australopithecus probably consumed all sorts of savanna delicacies, including fruits and nuts and seeds and grasses, although questions remain about what ancient hominids actually favored in their diet. The only reason that the authors bring this up is because male hominids foraged in a much more limited area, so it's entirely unclear how these males avoided predators such as saber-toothed cats while competing for food with baboons and other animals. Just another mystery to be solved, I guess. Well, it is now traditional that we end the show with an ant story, although I suspect this is becoming a bit overwrought, like Ricky Gervais's monkey news. Tonight's ant story can be found published in the new issue of Physiologica Entomologica. It was written by Dr. Alejandro Fargi Brenner and his colleagues from the Universidad Nacional in Argentina, and is entitled, quote, "The Truck Driver Effect in Leaf-Cutting Ants, How Individual Load Influences the Walking Speed of Nestmates," unquote. The study itself investigated and quantified the effects of heavily laden ants on foraging traffic in the leaf-cutting ant species Atacephalates. First of all, what do ants have to do with truck drivers? Well, the truck driver effect occurs when a heavily laden truck slows down the normally faster cars. We have all experienced this on a one-lane highway in a construction zone, with a slow truck trapping 30 cars behind him on the single lane who simply can't escape. This is related to ants because ants have the same potential problem for slowing down the whole of the foragers when a single forager carries oversized loads back to the nests. When carrying resources from a collecting point to the nest, one would assume that ants would attempt to carry as much as possible to maximize their foraging efforts. However, among social insects, that's not always the best strategy. Foragers carrying large loads might overwhelm the individuals processing the resources in the nest and cause a bottleneck on the ant highway, slowing everybody down. Additionally, a heavy load slows the carrier itself down. That may not be a significant cost for a lone forager who has taken a massive load upon himself, but it may reduce the gains for a colony as a whole. It seems that carrying loads well below the maximum carrying performance actually reduces the burden on the resource processors and speeds up the forager, allowing for more foraging trips per unit time. Of course, additionally, there is the actual truck driver effect, which can be seen in ants. Since the ants often forage along well-defined trails, slow, overburdened individuals can potentially cause traffic problems. In that context, when one ant is slowed down by a heavy load, it also slows down those ants following behind, regardless of their load size. Fargi Brenner's ant studies were done in Costa Rica. His first studies characterized ants and load sizes by collecting individual ants and their loads and determining leaf cutting and ant dorsal surface areas. Highly laden ants were 25% bigger and carried 100% larger loads than the ordinary laden ants. They then performed field manipulation experiments on foragers of several ant colonies, which is basically another way of saying that they messed with the ants' collective heads. In the first experiment, they identified highly laden ants and measured walking speeds for these ants and the ordinary laden ant following directly behind them, and another nearby ant as a control. They then removed the highly laden ant and mimicked the removal motion over the control ant, which to me is a kind of weird control, but then again, what do I know about ants? After 5 seconds, they measured the treated ant, which was the one with the heavily laden ant taken away, and the control ant speeds. Removal of the burdened ants from traffic increased ordinary laden ants' walking speeds from 1.9 to 2.9 centimeters per second. In the second experiment, they created highly laden ants to potentially slow down traffic. Initially, the speeds of two ordinary laden non-consecutive ants were measured. Then the load mass of an ant directly ahead of one of the two measured ants was artificially increased by adding a 10 milligram piece of aluminum foil on top of her leaf cutting. After 10 seconds, the speeds of the treated ant, that is, the one following the created highly laden ant and another control, were measured again. The creation of highly laden ants reduced their follower speed from 2.4 to 1.6 centimeters per second. And you are saying, so what? Isn't that obvious? Well, you've got to remember that nothing is obvious in science until you actually do the experiment. The results clearly show how ant load can impact the overall colony foraging rate and, by extension, intra-colony fitness. Again, as silly as the work sounds, it demonstrates that ants have remarkable flexibility in foraging behavior, and the result supports the idea that leaf-cutting ants make choices not only as individuals, but also collectively. Well, that's all for me for now. As always, take care, and need I say it, stay away from armadillos, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.